Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hey, back where we belong.
Love lifts us up where we belong.
That's my Joe Cocker. Thank you very much. Are you ready? Reggie? Yes, sir. Oh, sans sandwich today. No sandwich. Mm-hmm. That's some resolution for 2020. We'll see how well that goes. All right, very good. Well, then you are clearly ready to go. No distractions. No mayonnaise around the side of your mouth. No lettuce sitting on top of the console in the production room there. Good. Wow. Look at you, all professional. Well, then let's do professional podcasting right now, if there is such a thing. Okay. Levels look good in here. How about there, yeah? They're bouncing the same way, right? Good, 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 good. All right, let's go. Talent is ready. Mic is hot. Three S's. Star. Smile. Strong. And let's get started. 3, 2. Oh, by the way, write it down in the book. Number 193. Yeah. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted for your podcasting pleasure. We have been ranked binge-worthy by the Good Housekeeping Seal of Podcasts. If such a thing existed. On WGNplus.com, every Monday, new podcast is posted, or wherever you download your favorite podcast. This podcast, Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, is there for you. So don't forget to subscribe, to rate, and of course, most important of all, to spread the word and tell your friends, send them a link, send them a message. Send them the word that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and they should be listening to it. If you like what you're here, whether you're a long-term listener or new to the podcast, if you'd like to hear previous podcasts dating back all the way to May of 2016, go to WGNplus.com. There is an entertainment prompt there, and within that prompt there is another prompt for Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, where you can find all previous 192 episodes. 192 episodes, which according to my calculator, wait a minute, there we go, is 193. This is 193. So welcome to 193. As we once again forge ahead and we look to the horizon, 200 is within sight. Exciting. 200 and almost 4 years of podcasting. Who would have thought that? So welcome back, or welcome. I'm Elton Jim, and this is Captain Podtastic. I have a couple of topics I'd like to talk about today. Sometimes we just do one topic and I go off on some nice little tangents, but I'm going to try to be a little more focused today because I've got a couple of things that I'd like to discuss. The first one is something that I had no idea existed, found it completely by accident. And since I have discovered it, I have been obsessed with it. And I have to share this with you. We are weekly good friends at this point, I hope, with most of you. And so that's my goal here, is, as I said, to create an ongoing dialogue and, I guess, virtual friendship, if you will. And so part of that is sharing cool things that that either happened to you or that you happen upon. And I happened upon this, and I have to share it with you. One of the cool things and also one of the frustrating things about Netflix is that, you know, there's no, like, there's no guide to it. And I think that's by design. I do get some emails from Netflix to say, hey, we've got some new things for you. But I'll be honest, I delete those because I just feel like they're, you know, just generic, even though it says, hey, Jim, we've got some shows that are adding that you may like. But I always feel that those are a little generic. Although, with the algorithms today, they probably do narrow it down based on your viewing habits as to what you watch. So I actually shouldn't delete those because maybe they would come. Maybe they would be helpful to me. I'm going to start to actually read those now after this, because I would imagine that this show or this program was probably included in one of those emails that I deleted without even opening. So maybe that's going to be a New Year's resolution, is read my Netflix push emails. That's an easy one. I think I could fulfill that New Year's resolution. Although, is it too late to make New Year's resolutions in February? I don't know. I don't think there's any hard, fast rules here, but it might be just a little too late. But it's never too late to make a resolution, right? It's never too late to improve yourself. Now I sound like Oprah. That's scary. So I click on Netflix. As I said, what's frustrating about it is, and I think it's part of the design, they want you on there all the time, scanning around and scrolling around and surfing around to see what's on there. And so, and I believe that they think that people go there, they want people to go there on a daily basis, because new programs are just kind of there all of a sudden. And sometimes they're gone all of a sudden. There may be some advance warning. There might be some, as I said, maybe in these emails I talked about, or maybe there's some kind of online program guide like the old TV guides used to be. But for the most part, it seems to me that I happen upon things on Netflix. There are some very well-publicized original shows that are there that I'm aware of. And I go there specifically when they do appear on Netflix. But many times, as I said, I'm just scrolling around and going, oh, whoa, what's this? And I think that's what they want. They want you to make Netflix part of your daily routine. You wake up, you brush your teeth, you wash your face, you do a little flossing, you take your shower, you comb your hair, you get dressed, and you go on Netflix. They, you know, and you have your breakfast. They want that to be part of that routine. Maybe that works. Maybe that doesn't. Obviously, they're aimed at a tech savvy audience that is on the computer or on the phone all the times, and maybe is always looking at Netflix on a daily basis to update. We'll see. I don't do that. But maybe I'll have to start doing that. Maybe I'm missing some good stuff. I don't know, because and I'm getting a whole new perspective on this, because as I said, I found this by complete accident, and I have been hypnotized and mesmerized by it. And I'm actually happy to see that after I discovered it, more people discovered it, and now it's been a little more publicized online. But in case you haven't heard about it, there is a it's classic David Lynch. And David Lynch, of course, is a very well-known writer and director and actor, known probably best for the Twin Peaks television show, which kind of shocked and changed television back in the late 80s and early 90s. And for films like Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart and Mulholland Drive, many people don't realize that David Lynch, back in the, I believe it was even 1980, directed the film version of The Elephant Man with Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt, produced by Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks, known as one of the greatest comedians of our time, has also got a very keen eye for talent, and he plucked David Lynch out of obscurity to direct The Elephant Man. And I remember seeing that film when it first came out and feeling the same way that I do now about David Lynch stuff. Mesmerized, completely captivated, and it remains one of my favorite films of all time. It's not just a moving story, but it is how David Lynch tells that story through the visuals and through his filmmaking perspective, as well as some amazing acting, obviously, by Anthony Hopkins and John Hurt and Anne Bancroft, who, you know, not surprisingly, has a role in that movie, not only because was a great actress, but she's married to Mel Brooks. So it all ties in there. But so David Lynch's career goes back many decades. But as I said, Blue Velvet was another film that in the early mid-90s that shook the Hollywood establishment. And he's continued to just make movies that that baffle, that may sometimes don't make much sense, but are visually arresting. And that's the only word I could say. And they are hypnotic in their presentation and in their tone and in the mood that they set. They are absurd at times, and yet they are so real. And that's what I think is David Lynch's greatest talent and greatest ability, is to somehow meld the completely absurd with reality and make it make sense. A true original. If you don't like or don't know David Lynch's films, I would urge you to look them up. And now in today's world with Netflix and other streaming services, it's very easy to do that. Or just go back and watch the original Twin Peaks, at least the first season, which was pretty much all David Lynch and really was his vision. Twin Peaks changed television. After Twin Peaks, many of the great television dramas that we now view as classics, even in the last several years, like Breaking Bad, a clear dotted line, if not straight line, to the influence of something like Twin Peaks. It really did change television in that what could be shown on network television, as well as a new perspective of how to tell a story and how to take perhaps some of the underbelly and the harder and scary and sadistic and unpleasant parts of life and of the human experience and portray them juxtaposed to what our hopes and optimisms and dreams are of what reality is. And that's really what David Lynch does. And a lot of times people will see a David Lynch movie and they'll say, well, this, I don't understand this. This makes no sense. And a lot of times that's the intention. We are always obviously grasping for a pure plot line. And I believe that David Lynch works and films and TV shows, his entire visual kind of presentation is not meant to really make sense. There's not a pure, straight storyline. In fact, in many ways, he describes his films as dreamlike in that maybe they are dreams altogether. And think about it. How many of our dreams really make sense? Our dreams don't follow a very strict plot line. How many times do you wake up and you find a very vivid dream and you remember certain aspects and certain visuals or certain events that occurred and you say, and I don't know why the heck I was at this place with that person doing this, but in the scope of my dream, it made complete sense. I think that's what David Lynch is doing in many of his movies. He's bringing dreams to life. And the illogical parts of the dreams, as well as the vivid visual pictures of our dreams. And so that's what I would, if you've watched David Lynch movies in the past and you've said, geez, this is off the wall and I'm not getting it. And what's that? And how did that happen? And that can't make sense. Maybe it's the perspective that you're watching the films from. Don't go in expecting a very logical storyline that ties up all ends and even makes sense from scene to scene. Look at it from a perspective of what is being shown and offered visually and even through the dialogue. There's a dotted line of a story. There is a foundational story there, but it will drift in many different directions and maybe come to an ending that we don't expect or don't understand. And once again, isn't that what a dream does? Mulholland Drive, one of his best films, is that way. It's kind of frustrating. It's visually, as I said before, arresting or captivating. You can't keep your eyes off of it. But you're trying to make sense of it sometimes. You go, what the heck is going on here? Another one is called Lost Highway. There's at times where it's the soundtrack is very aggressive and off-putting. And the story is filled with tension. And you're just nervousness. But you can't, at least in my view, you can't take your eyes off of it. And so I'm a huge David Lynch fan. And as I said, I didn't even know that David Lynch directed Elephant Man back when I first saw it. Didn't even know who he was, but I was certainly impressed with that movie. And later on, when I became a David Lynch fan and found out he directed Elephant Man, I was kind of happy to say, well, at least I'm not jumping on the bandwagon. There was something about his work that appealed to me even then, when I was 16 years old. So through the years, I have remained a David Lynch fan and have seen all of his films, and he's written and recorded records and produced albums. He was responsible for the renaissance of Roy Orbison's career. In Blue Velvet, there is the use of In Dreams, and a classic Roy Orbison film or song from the 60s, and Roy Orbison in the 80s wasn't even well known anymore. Whoa, sorry about that. Wasn't really known or even listened to much anymore. And but David Lynch felt that song, In Dreams, completely fit in his film and put it in there, and it introduced a whole new audience to Roy Orbison's music and his career, and ultimately, as I said before, was responsible for his his comeback, which then included being in the Traveling Wilburys, and then sadly he passed away soon after that, but it was David Lynch's use of the song In Dreams in Blue Velvet, which brought people back to Roy Orbison's music. And in fact, David Lynch then went on to produce a Roy Orbison album of Roy Orbison re-recording many of his classic hits like Pretty Woman and Blue Bayou and In Dreams, obviously, and Only the Lonely. And so David Lynch is an artist above all. He is a visual artist, and he does paint, and he does sculptures, and he does other kinds of art. He's a furniture builder too. Very artistic guy. Clearly looks at life through a different prism, through a different lens, but that's what makes him interesting. And some of his art is way out there. Some of his, I'm not a wholesale David Lynch fan that everything he does I think is great. But I appreciate his vision. And so first thing is, if you've never really seen David Lynch or experienced his movies in any real way, now thanks to streaming services and the access to that, I would certainly suggest that you might want to try it out, knowing that it's going to be a little off kilter. It may be a little difficult at times to follow. You may be scratching your head, but I would just offer to stay with it. One of his earliest films is called Eraserhead, which, at the time was just viewed as a cult classic from the beginning. It was never going to make, be a mainstream film. But over time and over the years, it has gained respect. And once again, all I can tell you is you've got to see Eraserhead. I can't even explain it. And so many times with David Lynch films, that's the review. What the heck is going on here? And I really can't explain it, but I also know that I can't stop watching it. Which brings me to this new discovery that I made on Netflix a few weeks ago. I just put Netflix on, and they have the opening screen there with all the shows that you can scroll on, and new shows and coming attractions and things like that. And I see something by David Lynch that I've never seen before. And it's called What Did Jack Do? What Did Jack Do? And in the little preview there, there's just a little a face of David Lynch. And so I don't know what to expect here. I don't know if this is a full movie. I don't know what this is. I've never heard of it. Didn't know it was dropping on Netflix, but I'm a David Lynch fan, so I have to see it. And I click it on, and it turns out that I see by the time, the way they have the on the bottom of the screen there, you can see how long a program is on Netflix, and it's only 17 minutes long. And I'm like, huh, okay. So it's just kind of a little short little movie here. Interesting. And I know nothing about this, nothing, completely blind to this, which is odd for me. I usually come to a new movie or something with some knowledge of it, having read about it. But this was a total surprise. It was not on my radar screen in the past, and so it was kind of fun to actually experience this with virgin eyes, if you will. And so it starts off like many David Lynch kinds of things do, black and white, and of a moody background. And not surprisingly, if you've watched Twin Peaks, you know that he's used little people and all kinds of different unorthodox characters that have become iconic. The dancing little person, in Twin Peaks became, as I said, one of the main characters and iconic characters from Twin Peaks. So all of a sudden, I noticed that there's this, and you could hear it, it seems to be like a train station. And I'm not going to give the whole thing away, but basically, I noticed that there's like a small monkey sitting at a table wearing a suit and tie. So I know I'm in for something here. It's David Lynch, so I'm going to prepare myself. And suddenly David Lynch appears on screen and sits down. And it turns out that the plot of this is that David Lynch and this monkey are meeting in a train station that has been shut down by the police because there is a murderer on the loose. And quickly we find out that David Lynch is a tough-talking, chain-smoking detective who is clearly looking for this murderer, and he is intent on interrogating who seems to be his key suspect, this monkey, who has a name, Jack Cruz, C-R-U-Z. And of course, if it's a David Lynch project, the monkey talks. And so for 17 minutes in black and white, with just tight close-ups of David Lynch and this monkey named Jack Cruz, David Lynch interrogates the monkey about a murder. And that's the premise of What Did Jack Do? Jack being the monkey. And through the use of obviously some technology, some great cinematography, and I don't know if this monkey was manipulated visually through computers or was trained, but as absurd as this scenario is, a detective interrogating a monkey for a murder, after the first minute, the dialogue between them in the typical David Lynch fashion, the dialogue is fast and quick, and as I said before, absurd and disjointed, and it's like an impressionistic painting, or it's like a modern art painting visually and audio. There's some lines that don't make sense at all, but they sound very cool. But we find out through this exchange, through this interrogation, of what did Jack do. And it's, as I said before, it is captivating and compelling. And and after a minute, you don't even, you're so into what's going on and the story and how Jack the monkey is responding to David Lynch's interrogation that you forget that a monkey is being interrogated. And the questions sometimes in this murder are, of course, absurd and crazy and silly and off the wall. But within the context of this little world that David Lynch has created, they make perfect sense. And you are immediately hooked into finding out what did Jack do, and is Jack the murderer, even though he's a talking monkey. And he talks about his girlfriend, Tutuban, his girlfriend, who is a chicken. This is what I mean. Completely absurd. Makes no sense, but I guarantee you, if you give it a chance, if you stay with it and you watch this, you will get sucked in by this scene of this interrogation, in both the questions and the answers, and then of course, in true David Lynch fashion, Jack Cruz, the monkey, then breaks out into song. in some overly dramatic, lushly orchestrated love song that comes out of nowhere, which is pure Lynchian. Now, I believe that Jack Cruz's voice is David Lynch as well. It's been a little altered, but I believe it's David Lynch as well. David Lynch wrote, directed, edited, you know, acts in. I think he's both Jack Cruz, the voice, as well as obviously the detective. He designed the set. He did all of it. As I said, he's really just a pure artist and really just a creative visionary. But all I can tell you is give this a shot. It's only 17 minutes long, first of all. But stay with it. Even if you're going, what the heck is this? I'm already quoting lines from this. I watched this at least 5 times after the first time I saw it. I was like, okay, I don't know. I mean, this is what I love about sometimes movies, and especially David Lynch things and other movie directors like him, where you go, I don't know what that was, and I can't wait to watch it again. That's what's exciting to me about a movie. And it's the same thing here, 17 minutes, so it's not going to take too much of your time. But I watched it 5 times in a row, and to the point where, as I said, I was beginning to memorize it, and I'm already quoting it in my normal daily routine because there's so many great lines. So all I could ask is that you try this out. It's on Netflix. It's called What Did Jack Do? And in fact, so I found out later, I did a little research on it. It appeared on Netflix without any fanfare at all, just kind of mysteriously dropped in true David Lynch fashion on his birthday, January 20th, this year, 2020, which is his 74th birthday. Next week on the Academy Awards, David Lynch will be getting a Lifetime Achievement Award. He's never won an Academy Award as Best Director for his films, but certainly his contribution to filmmaking in the last 40 years has been unique and original and influential and entertaining and important, and I'm glad to see this. If he never won one in the competition, I'm glad the Academy is recognizing his contribution, because he is a true original. And so obviously what perfect timing to drop this short little film that apparently, as I did more research, as I said, is not new. It was first debuted several years ago, back in 2017, as part of a bigger event. He had a book of nudes that he put out, and he showed this film as part of the entire rollout of the book in Paris. And then in 2018, he showed it at a film festival in New York. So it's not completely new, but certainly the masses have never seen it. It was only shown in very small, venues for a short period of time, maybe even one time. And so now it's getting a full-blown release, and people are certainly reacting to it in the way that exactly David Lynch would want you to react, which is scratch your head, but also keep watching it. And as I said, Jack Cruz, the monkey, sings a short little blurb of a song within this, and it's mesmerizing to hear him sing. And now, on the heels of the release of What Did Jack Do, there is a 2-song EP, extended play, of 2 songs by Jack Cruz, one that's in the film called True Love's Flame, and another one. And you can download these or, in a few months, get them on vinyl. So we may not have seen the end of Jack Cruz. He's now got an album out. And he is the captivating star, along with David Lynch, of this 17-minute film noir short. It looks came like it comes right out of the 50s. As I said, black and white, David Lynch playing the hard-nosed, chain-smoking detective and being interrogated, and Jack Cruz, the monkey, trying to talk his way out of being of being arrested or being accused of this murder. If it all makes no sense to you, that's all the more reason why I urge you to go on Netflix and take a look at what I think is one of the most interesting pieces of film that I've seen in a long time. 17 minutes long. You can't beat that. David Lynch. In fact, here's a little clip of Jack Cruz singing.
Once upon a time we danced. Once upon a time we took a chance and fell in love.
Oh. What Did Jack Do? By David Lynch on Netflix right now. All I can say is, if you want to say, Jim, what do you like? This gives you a little insight. I've tried to share as much as of different things that I like, you know, entertainment wise, music wise, movie wise. This is what I like. I can't stop watching it. I discovered it I think the day after, on the 21st, and I have watched it at least once. I watched it five or six times right after I saw it, and I have watched it at least once or twice a day since then. Can't get this out of my mind. And now there's a chance to have a few songs by Jack Cruz, the singing monkey and suspected murderer. David Lynch, What Did Jack Do? On Netflix. Check it out. Another thing I wanted to discuss today is, obviously a very sad story, which has dominated the news cycle since it occurred a few weeks ago, with Kobe Bryant's tragic and untimely death in a helicopter accident, which really shocked the world. I did not know about it until about 5 o'clock in the evening that day. My wife and I went out with my wife's mother to celebrate her birthday, and we were, you know, in the car and then in a restaurant right as the story broke, and then, you know, as it began to develop. And so we went to her home after we had dinner to celebrate her her birthday. And we were just sitting around, and we didn't even have the TV on for most of our visit after dinner. And for whatever reason, my mother-in-law turned the television on just as we were about to leave. And I don't know what channel she had on. I think she had some kind of a, you know, 24-hour news channel. And all of a sudden, there's the news that Kobe Bryant was killed in a helicopter crash. And my gosh, we were just stunned. A, that we didn't hear, you know, we hadn't heard about it. And just what a shocking story. It was very similar. I had the same reaction to some extent, in terms of the pure shock of when, upon hearing the news of when Lady Diana, Princess Diana, was killed. Very similar situation from my standpoint. We were not aware that Diana was killed until the next morning. You know, that story happened late in the evening and developed overnight. Yes, now by then, you know, in 1997, obviously, there was 24-hour news. But the thing is that, once again, my wife and I had gone that night to visit a friend. And we went there and we watched several movies on DVD. And so we did not have the regular television on. Even though we were watching television, we had watched a series of DVDs and never turned the regular television on. And we were there throughout the evening and even into the early morning. By the time we got home, it was probably 1 or 2 in the morning. I did not have the radio on in the car. And on our way home, and it wasn't a long drive, we were just talking. And then when we came home, it was 1 or 2 in the morning and didn't turn the TV on again and just fell asleep. And then the next morning, I wake up and I go out and get the newspaper and my wife is still sleeping. It's, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning and I get up early. It was a Sunday morning. I'll never forget. And I look at the newspaper and the headline is, you know, Princess Diana killed in car crash. And I remember just stopping and reading this. First of all, being shocked that we had not heard about it at all. We were so isolated from the breaking news cycle that we hadn't turned a TV or radio on in obviously 12 or so hours that we had no idea this happened. It was like, you know, back in the old days when you heard about news, picking up the newspaper the next morning. That's what it was like. That experience is gone now. We know about news when it happens because of so much access to information. But, 40, 50 years ago, you depended on the newspaper to tell you what happened that next morning. That's how the news cycle worked. We were so unconnected that many times we didn't know about the news till the next day. If something happened between 11 o'clock at night, for instance, and 5 in the morning, you did not know about it until you woke up. There was no way to know. The 10 o'clock news was over and news was done. As far as television was concerned, news was finished and the newspaper was your next source. Perhaps if you listened to radio overnight, news radio, you would hear it. But if not, if you depended on television and newspapers as your main news source, after the 10 o'clock news ended at 10:30, whatever happened, in the next 7 hours or so, you didn't learn until you picked up the newspaper. And that's how I felt when I found out about Lady Di's tragic death in Paris. Picked it up and saw the newspaper. I remember screaming upstairs, "You're never going to guess who died." And then, of course, the next move was to go to the television and turn it on and find out, you know, that it was 24-hour wall-to-wall coverage on this. And we were way, way behind the story by the time that we picked it up. And then, of course, it just became, the news of the month. I mean, it was just every minute was news about that that tragic crash. And so that's how this felt. Once again, we were kind of isolated from any kind of outside information, just going about our social experience of going out and celebrating my mother-in-law's birthday and coming back. And as I said, just kind of casually turned the television on as we were leaving. And we saw this news. Certainly shocking and very sad, especially the fact not only did Kobe Bryant pass away, but he was with his 13-year-old daughter, and then other members of his daughter's basketball team, 9 people in total. So just very tragic, sad story. Unfortunately, the circumstances, not all that surprising. Air-related deaths in private kinds of aircraft have become commonplace, sadly, dating all the way back to the famous band leader of the 40s, Glenn Miller, who died in a plane crash. Obviously, some other famous celebrities that have died in plane crashes include Buddy Holly in 1959 in February, and Jim Croce, the singer, in 1973. John Denver was flying a plane himself and crashed and died in the early 90s. Stevie Ray Vaughan, the blues guitarist, rock guitarist, in a helicopter, leaving the Alpine Valley Music venue in Wisconsin on a foggy night, and flew right into a hill, and now and there's and I know I'm missing other ones, but I'm just talking about ones that are coming right to the top of my head, and now Kobe Bryant, sadly, another private helicopter. Flying in the fog, obviously, you know, I'm just remembering now John F. Kennedy Jr., another fatality in a plane crash that he was flying in questionable weather at night without instruments. I mean, sadly, at the end of the day, most of these crashes do come down to a mix of pilot error and poor weather conditions. I'm thinking another one, obviously, back in the 70s, Lynyrd Skynyrd band, including their lead singer, Ronnie Van Zant. A few of the members did survive that, but a major plane crash that took Ronnie Van Zant, the lead singer of Lynyrd Skynyrd, in, I believe, 75 or 76. So clearly, and sadly, these are not... uncommon, but when they happen, they are a shock. By all accounts, it sounds as if Kobe Bryant flew by helicopter quite a bit as a part of his regular routine, and not only as a way to beat the horrible LA traffic, but because of his schedule, especially when he was playing. He had so few days off, especially during the season, you would use helicopters quite a bit to save time to spend time with his family. And so it became a very common part of the Bryant household. And so taking a helicopter to a basketball event would be just commonplace. But as we are finding more and more, as the story continues to develop, and the last account I heard is that they won't really have a full report and a full investigation done and given the entire details of the flight and the official proclamation of what the problem was for another year, perhaps, or 18 months. That's how thorough this investigation, many of these investigations are. But what we're getting here is obviously... it was a foggy day in the early morning, which is common in the California and Los Angeles area for a fog to come in the early morning. It eventually does rise and fade off. I've been a victim of that. I remember driving to early morning. I was out of San Francisco and wanted to go somewhere, and we had to turn around. Because it was 10 in the morning, and, you know, here in the Chicago area, we don't really have that kind of fog on a regular basis, and we just wanted to get an early start. And we said, well, let's get going, and we got onto the roads, and we could not see a foot in front of us. And, in fact, we did encounter some police that basically were closing the highway because you could not see. So I can understand what that kind of a fog out there on the West Coast is like in the early morning when this happened, apparently around 9:30 or so LA time. Because I remember having to turn around, and I can only imagine if you're flying in the air. So very sad situation. It appears as if both the foggy conditions as well as once again perhaps pilot error contributed to the fatal accident. But what I want to talk about is not so much that we've known now what's going on, or at least what happened to some extent, and there's been a huge outpouring of sorrow and remembrance of one of the NBA's greatest players and someone that seemed to also be a very devoted family man, as well as perhaps more and more as now his life away from basketball, only a couple of years since he retired and was probably going to get into more charitable kinds of work. Who knows? Now, we don't know. But I did want to talk about an aspect of the story, which I think is important, that has not been getting a lot of play, but I noticed right away, and then an event happened which brought more of a spotlight to it. In fact, I could once again bring it right back to my own personal reaction and personal discovery of the news. When we were at my mother-in-law's house and she turns the TV on, and boom, right away, as soon as the picture appears on the screen, that's what we encounter, is this headline across the crawl of the screen that says, you know, NBA star Kobe Bryant killed in helicopter crash. And we're just like, whoa. You know, once again, you know, you're kind of frozen in time for a couple of seconds there. And my mother-in-law says, you know, I always liked him. You know, he seemed to be a likable player. She's not a big basketball fan, but somehow within the osmosis of pop culture, she had seen some things of Kobe Bryant, and for whatever reason, she seemed to have formed an opinion that she liked him, which is fine. And from all the accounts of the people that knew him, not only just Laker fans and basketball fans who admired his talents on the court, but people that knew him personally, you know, there was a great, and this continues to be a great outpouring of loss and sadness and, you know, high regard for him. And I would assume in a couple of weeks, when the NBA All-Star Game takes place right here in Chicago on February 16th, that whatever the plans were for that game, it's now going to turn into a Kobe Bryant tribute. I'm sure that whoever's working on that event, whatever they had planned a few weeks ago when this happened, they had to get working on, okay, what do we do? The Grammy Awards that night, which was ironic, the Grammy Awards were held in the Staples Center where Kobe Bryant played for so many years as a Laker. And even they were, you know, the show really took on more of a tribute to Kobe within the process of the entire award show as well. But I mean, actually, it was taking place, you know, in the Staples Center where Kobe Bryant played so long. So that was almost surreal. But I'm sure the NBA All-Star Game is going to be just as moving because he was one of the best players in NBA history, and you know, an All-Star for many many years of that career. So. Again, very fitting that the All-Star Game, I'm sure, will, you know, honor him. But so as when my mother-in-law said, I always liked him, without missing a beat, I said, well, yeah, I mean, he was certainly a very popular player and one of the best in the, you know, in the history of the NBA. But, you know, there was also that that rape incident. And my mother-in-law kind of turned to me and she said, oh, what? And I said, well, yeah, you know, about 15 years or so ago, he was accused of raping a woman that was a hostess at a hotel in the Vail area. And the reason why that is so imprinted on me is because that summer he went to the Vail area, Eagle, Colorado area, to get some kind of knee surgery. There was some, you know, sports medicine surgeon that did his work in that area. And I believe that the Kobe Bryant incident took place in June of, I believe, 2003. And my wife and I were there in August. And we stayed in the general area, not where he was at, but in the general area. But, I mean, that story that summer was all over the place. It was all over the news. And it was a he said, she said situation. He denied it. He didn't deny he had sex with her, but he denied that it was a rape. He said it was consensual. Ultimately, the story made huge headlines. It was as I said, for over the whole summer, and being in that area, that's all people were talking about when we were there for 3 or 4 days, because it was the talk of that town, as well as the talk of the country, and certainly the talk of the sporting world, because at that time, Kobe Bryant was, you know, at the height of his basketball powers too. So for this to come out was certainly a shock, especially because he had always been portrayed as a family man. And we've seen that many times. We saw that with so many athletes. Tiger Woods, obviously, is one that comes to mind, that portrayed this very clean-cut family image, and then it turned out to be quite the opposite. Same thing with Michael Jordan. And so the Kobe thing not only took people by surprise that you know, he had been caught fooling around, but that this was a rape charge. This was a criminal charge, not just infidelity like Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods, but this was actually a criminal case. And ultimately, the case was dropped. There was a settlement. You never really found out what happened here. I don't know if Kobe Bryant had just decided to give the woman some money to drop the charges. It sort of all went away, but it was a huge, huge story for many, many months, and is a part of his life story. And so even at the moment of the announcement of his death and learning of it, that's what came to my mind as well. And when we got home, I turned on the television to watch the coverage to find out more as the story continued to develop. And, you know, most of the coverage that day, on the day of the death, was all about tributes, and people were distraught. They were showing all the crowds gathering at the Staples Center and all the fans crying, and the memorials and the vigils, and friends and fans talking about, you know, what kind of person he was for those who knew him, in very glowing terms. Fans talking about how they, you know, idolized him and were just, you know, mesmerized and, you know, appreciative of his talents and the times they saw him in person play games, or, you know, watched him on television, and he was a role model and an influence and their favorite player, and they had the jerseys and the whole thing that sports fans go through. And as I said, we're getting this complete, sad and intense outpouring of grief and sadness and of glowing tributes of Kobe Bryant, which by all accounts seemed to be well deserved. But I also did notice that in all of the coverage of what people were talking about, and when they would start off, say, at the top of the hour, and if you're just hearing, Kobe Bryant, 41 years old, retired L.A. Laker, sadly was never officially inducted into the Hall of Fame, but probably would have been inducted in the next couple of years. You usually have to wait, 5 years or so until you retire to be eligible. He no doubt would have been inducted. He was the number 3 scorer in NBA history. Although when he died, he was number 4. Because on the day before he passed away, ironically, LeBron James passed him on the all-time scoring list. So Kobe Bryant's name was in the news, you know, within the last 3 or 4 days before his death. I remember reading about this, that LeBron James was approaching, overtaking Kobe Bryant on the all-time scoring list. So all of a sudden, Kobe Bryant's name was in the sports page for a couple of 3 days later. I remember picking up the paper that morning and reading that LeBron James had, in fact, passed Kobe Bryant. And then, what, 5-6 hours later, I read about his death. So it was surreal even for me. I'm not a huge NBA fan, but certainly, you know, I watched my share, you know, championship games or all-star games, and I knew who Kobe Bryant was. So I didn't have a big personal attachment to him. I wasn't a huge NBA fan where I watched games all the time and really saw a lot of him, but I certainly knew of him and knew he was one of the best players, and I have seen him perform on TV. I don't think I ever saw him in person. But anyway, I didn't think it was anything in my mind to also temper the story somewhat and bring up the fact that there were these rape allegations, which were a huge, big story and are a part of his history. And I was noticing that in the coverage, there was no mention of this at all. And if you were not around for that, if you were not born, if you were, say, 14 or 15 years old, you may not even know that that happened. And I found that a little strange. I understand that this person just died, and you know, you this is somebody that is revered and idolized, but at the same time, there also needs to be some objectivity, and that was a part of his story. And I just found that there seemed to be no mention of it at all. And I've just found that kind of odd, and I felt like, you know, I understand there's, you know, show some respect, but, you know, I always also wondered, you know, if Pete Rose had died in a plane crash, would they not have talked about the fact that he was banned from baseball for gambling? Or would they have just talked about the fact that he has the most hits in the history of the game and he was a many-time All-Star and one of the best players of his generation? Would they have not mentioned he was banned from baseball for cheating? I think they would have, because Pete Rose is not really that popular with people. And so I was wondering, it's like, so are we playing a game here now that when there's someone that we collectively admire and love, we shy away from their bad points in their lives, and everybody has them, and we just focus on and if we do bring it up, you know, we're viewed as being insensitive. But if there's someone that we really don't like, then we have no problems mixing the bad with the good, and that's a problem. I have a problem with that. There's this view of, oh, too soon for that. Person just died or something bad happened. Too soon. I don't believe there's anything too soon. It's a part of the person's story. And if we are celebrating the person, if we are remembering the person's life, it's only right to bring up all of it. Not just the good things that make us feel good. Yes, tragic story. The guy was killed in a helicopter accident with his daughter. I understand that. But I also don't believe that you whitewash history. And apparently, there was a reporter. I found this out a couple of days after. There was a reporter for the Washington Post who, on her Twitter account, while all the heartfelt and, you know, tributes were coming in about Kobe over the world, she felt that she had the responsibility to remind people of this story if they forgot about it or if they never knew about it. Because that's what journalism is. It's an objective view. The subjective was getting a lot of airplay all over every news outlet. But the objective view of Kobe Bryant's life and this rape allegation, which was very serious, and the detail that the woman initially described, and then suddenly she dropped it. So, as I said, you can find your own conclusion to that. But she made some very, very detailed and very disturbing allegations against him in terms of this sexual assault. You should know that. And so, all this reporter did from the Washington Post was on her Twitter account put a link to this story from 2003 about Kobe Bryant's sexual assault case. Well, apparently this reporter was inundated by over 10,000 emails and Twitter responses, almost all of them angry, threatening to kill her, threatening to rape her. Somebody then found out her address and printed it online as a way to say, hey, go get her. These were all people that were obviously big Kobe Bryant fans who felt that she was wrong for bringing this up in the midst of his death because it was too soon or it was not respectful of him. To the point where the woman had to leave her apartment for fear of some kind of violence against her. And then to top it off, her boss at the Washington Post even made a statement that said, you are not, you know, admonishing her and saying how she was not doing good for the world of journalism by bringing this up at this time. And her initial tweet then was deleted, and she was suspended. Now, as I record this, I don't know if she's going to be reinstated or fired or what is going to happen to her, but I believe that that is completely wrong. She was doing a job as a journalist. She was offering an objective view. And I don't think there's anything too soon. If we're going to remember this person, if we're going to give praise to this person, I also believe that it's fair and okay to talk about their pitfalls. That's what makes them human. And that's the role of journalism. And sadly, when you've got even a high-ranking official at the Washington Post falling into this too soon, as opposed to remembering the real role and the real rules of journalism to offer an objective view, not just all subjective. That's what the public will do. It's the media's role. It's journalism's role, at least it used to be, of offering the objective part of this. The facts, the realities, and allowing the public to take in the facts as well as whatever personal feelings they had, and process those all together. But it's the role of journalism, at least it used to be, to offer that. And I believe we are losing that. Journalism itself has been completely chipped away by social media. Everybody now is kind of a quasi-reporter. We have we have rumors that are thrown out on the internet, go around the world as fact. They are not checked. They are not verified. Journalism has become, sadly, diluted by social media. And we need those journalistic standards. And I speak once again, maybe I'm biased, but I started my career as a journalist and as a reporter and an editor, and I was schooled in that. You cannot write this. You cannot print this. You cannot say this unless you have verified it by at least two people. Watch the movie All the President's Men and see how the Robert Redford character and the Dustin Hoffman character who played Woodward and Bernstein have to go to great lengths in order to get validation and confirmation for what they are saying. And the same thing here. All this reporter was doing was letting people know that amidst all these these well-deserving tributes to Kobe Bryant, there was this other part of his life and his story that people might have forgotten. There was a woman out there who believes she was right by Kobe Bryant. Doesn't her story and her voice deserve to be told amidst this, if we're talking about his life and his career? Because that was part of it. But nobody wanted to talk about that. Because we are now in an age that we are completely emotionally driven. That's another outgrowth of social media. We are getting not verified facts, but clear opinions. Opinions based on very little information or knee-jerk reactions. And that's now becoming how we react. And that's becoming our new standard. And that's scary. And I hope if newspapers feel that they have any role anymore, because the newspaper business has been so diluted and attacked and declined by the internet, if the media, the newspapers that still exist, like the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune, if they are going to be, if they're going to have any role in our society anymore, they can't break news. That's over with. They are not news breaking anymore. They react to news because the internet is immediate and split second and access is everywhere. So newspapers no longer break news. But what their role, if they want to have an important role, is that they have to be our conscience and our compass and offer objective facts and views. Because the internet is going to take care of all the emotional and rumors and knee-jerk reactions. That's all going to come out. So we need some journalistic pillars who remain objective. But now you know, the newspapers are so afraid of their extinction that they're falling in the same thing. They're following there's this many views and this many likes, so we can't say anything wrong against that. No, that's your job. In the news business, in the journalism business, there's no such thing as too soon. And even in our personal lives, we have to start to get away from this emotional reaction, new normal. That's no way to live. We've got to have a balance. Yes, I felt bad when Kobe Bryant died. But I also was objective enough to say he was a flawed human being. And you say, well, Jim, what happens? What's going to happen when Bruce Springsteen dies or Elton John dies, someone that you like? Yeah, I will say the same thing. I will be emotionally saddened and touched, but I also won't whitewash. We can't whitewash, folks. We can't rewrite history. I'm not condemning Kobe Bryant. I don't know if he did it or not, but somebody made these allegations, and the police station and the police departments and the state's attorneys and attorneys and the government took those allegations against him seriously enough to charge him. So there had to be some validity there. That's a part of the story. So my question is, when is too soon too soon? In my view, it's not soon enough. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted for your podcasting pleasure at either WGNplus.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and pass on the good word to your friends that you listen to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Hope you enjoyed episode number 193. I certainly did, and your devotion and loyalty is much appreciated. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. This has been Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screen.